Today is September 1st, 1999. Our speaker this evening is Bob Saray. He's the editor of our newsletter, The Caboose. The Cumberland Township Historical Society meeting. This is the first of our 1999 year.
Okay, I think we'll start. There's another gentleman who's a Fobet who might come from Hull tonight, but he's not here yet, and I think we should get things going. I want to welcome everybody to the September meeting of the Cumberland Township Historical Society. My name is Bob Saray, and I'm going to be talking about the Fobet family tonight, one of the first to settle in the township. And somebody already asked the question, is there any Fobet blood in me for me to be standing up in front of you here and talking about the Fobet family? And the answer is no. But I think I still have to explain a few things so that you know where I'm coming from. First of all, I've been a member of the society for about a little bit more than 2 years. I've been interested in Cumberland history for a bit more than 3 years. I've done some local history for Ottawa, and I've studied Franco-Ontarian genealogies for Ottawa. I've been interested in genealogy itself since 1972, and that would be the crux of my gusto. What interests me most is genealogy. Franco-Ontarian genealogy in particular, although I've done a lot of Quebec genealogy, but I realize there's a big need in Ontario for that, and there's not a lot of people doing it. Another thing that's interesting about me is that I own a little bit more than 1 acre of land on the original Fobet, where they settled.
Estate.
That's a nice word for it. Because he owned about 200 acres. Now, I'm not Fobet, who happens to be right here in the middle. He's the first one to come to the Cumberland Township. He's the one who bought land from the Dunning family. Lot 14, concession 1, old survey. And my dad bought a property, about an acre on that land in 1956 from Jim Morin. And the Morins had it from other people, and the other people had it from Fobet, and Fobet, it went all the way back. This is a picture of Napoleon Fobet, who is the sixth generation, not from Amami, but from the first one who came to America, who was Jean-Baptiste. And there's people here tonight who are related to Napoleon. He's already the fourth generation from Amable who settled in the township, and there's two ahead of Amable. What I'm going to do tonight is not talk about Amable coming down, because some people know more about that than I do. But there's one thing that not too many people know more about in this land, and it's going up from Amab going back. I've noticed that that's been fairly well lost to most people. And there's a gentleman who's coming from Hull tonight, I hope. And he set up a website. Is the gentleman here? No. He set up a website on the Fobet family. And we've only, Jean-Francois, a member of our society, was able to pinpoint that site in the last couple of weeks. And we invited the gentleman from Hull to come over. And you see how things kind of burgeon. You do something and it sets a whole series in motion. So I do have a few credentials to talk about the Fobet family, but basically I'm an avid researcher. And since they are the first French-Canadian family to come into the township and one of the first to settle here in any case, I decided to dig into their past. And I did it almost like a maniac, because I have actually sat in front of microfilms and gone through not just what refers to the Fobet family, but to everything. I've taken everything in case I might find tidbits, and you know what I did? It's like searching for gold. You find little tidbits, but you've got to do a lot of panning before you get those little nuggets. And I've got a whole bunch of nuggets to present to you tonight. And we're going to start at the beginning with Jean-Baptiste. Jean-Baptiste Fobet was born in Paris. around 1721, that's a long time ago. When he came to America, it was still the French regime. He lived a few years under the French regime before the British conquest of the last, not the last remnant, because there was still Louisiana, but before France lost its Canadian colony. 1760, Battle of the Plains of Abraham. It took 3 years for a treaty to be signed, but that was it for New France, and a whole new regime set in. Jean-Baptiste saw all that. He died in 1800. He married Geneviève Durocher, a Vaudreuil family. Let me just go into a little bit of the geography, because we're going to be talking about this on and off right through. This is a lopsided map, because really, if you've got Montreal over here, you'd expect to go a little bit like that to get to Hull, and you'd expect to go just about straight to follow the St. Lawrence. But there's an expression in French, les pays d'en haut, that means the up country. A lot of the ways of expressing these things are up, and I decided to draw a map straight up. Montreal is down here, St. Lawrence goes like this, and it's up the Ottawa River, and it doesn't stop in Hull. It goes up, up, up. At Mattawa, you break left. All the voyageurs, instead of following the river up into the Abitibi, Temiskaming, and all that, they went left on the Mattawa River. They were going into the up country. As far as Manitoba, Saskatchewan, after 100 years, they were all over North America through the Ottawa Gateway. Vaudreuil, this is still Quebec, up to about, well, Fortune Point. Rigaud and Vaudreuil are in Quebec, so is Oka. St. Andrew's East, that's all the Quebec side. And this is Upper Canada. We're going to stop talking about Quebec and Ontario. This is all Quebec, but this is all Upper Canada at the time we're talking about. It'll come into Canada West, Canada East, and all that. But these people, and I'm going to show you that there were other terms to designate all this area. It took a long time to get the names straightened out, but it was Upper Canada after 1791. So let's go back again. Jean-Baptiste married Geneviève Durocher in 1753 in Vaudreuil. He's from Paris, she's a local girl from a local family, Vaudreuil. I don't know why Jean-Baptiste left Paris to come to Vaudreuil. This is rough. This is rough country. Montreal has got maybe 6,000 people. That's not a big place. And he's not close to Montreal. He's in Vaudreuil. He's in the boonies. But there's good land there. And the land is so good that within two generations, a whole bunch of Americans will be coming up. Philemon Wright came up in 1800. But there will be a massive entry of many people, not just Americans, but people from the continent, from Europe, looking for good land and for their own land. Because I said this is the French regime. In France, Jean-Baptiste would not have hoped to own land. He would have been born in the seigneurial system where you honor a seigneur and you work for him and you get things in return, and he runs the mills and all that, and he defends you against the enemies. That's the feudal system that was still being used in France. And Jean-Baptiste, that's all he knew when he came to Canada. When he came to Vaudreuil, he was under a seigneur. There was a seigneurie in Vaudreuil. So he lived under that system, but his children lived to see another system, the British system, where you own your own land. So he marries Geneviève Durocher in Vaudreuil. That's in the register. November 8th, 1753. He was a farmer. I don't have any evidence that he did the fur trade. There was fur trade there, though. The temptation was too strong. There was money to be made. Possibly another reason for people to come to Vaudreuil. The Indians come down the river. They want to trade. if you intercept them at Beaudry, you trade before anybody else does. And the big companies don't like it. Hudson's Bay Company and the Northwest, they're still separate. They'll join in 1821, but in those backward days, the fur trade was the thing. And yet, Jean-Baptiste is a farmer. That's okay, because he wants to farm the land. He had 12 children with Geneviève, and they were all baptized the same day. So there's something puzzling there. Either they were very close to the church, or the priest made sure that he was there when the baby was born or something, or he was an important man, I don't know, but they, of the 12 children, I'd say 10 were born, they were baptized the same day they were born. Now that was a tradition too in the French, in the Catholic Church. Because if a baby died before he was baptized, he didn't go to heaven, he went to limbo. Not too good. So baptize as soon as you can so that his soul will go to heaven. This is how you recreate all kinds of little things in the past. You have to read between the lines. Jean-Baptiste is a rather important person because he signs his name. And that is insignificant today. But in those days, hardly anybody could read and write. And this man who comes from Paris, fresh, probably good French spoken, and he can sign his name. And I, by going through the registers, act by act, everybody, everything, I notice that he signed here and there at a wedding, or he's a godfather here. And he seems to have a little bit of prestige, because as a matter of fact, when they decide to build a stone church in Beaudry, they have a meeting, January 1783. He's in his 40s. And he's one of the important people, after the parish priest, of course, and the notary, the notaire. That's the man who writes down the whole thing. And maybe an odd doctor and the seigneur, he would be an important person also. But after that, it seems that Jean-Baptiste held a certain sway in the village. He was an important man. His son didn't sign his name. Gabriel was there. Jean-Baptiste, he had a son, Gabriel. He was there when they talked about the church in 1783, but he didn't sign his name. Doesn't mean he couldn't sign, but probably he couldn't. We'll talk about that again. He died in 1800, and there's a touching little note in the register. I'm going to read some of the acts word for word as I go through, because Catholic registries are a baptism would be 6 or 7 lines, a lot of information in there. When a person dies, 4 or 5 lines, not too much. A marriage is almost obscene because they've got a whole page. The guests, who was there, who was invited, the friends, who signed, all kinds of stuff, where they were from, how many announcements were made in the churches, what churches it was announced in. It was a big deal in the register and socially also for a wedding. So, but the touching note when Jean-Baptiste died is this. And I had noticed that after 1793, I'm looking at the registers and he doesn't show up anymore. And I said, oh, I wonder where he is. Well, when he died, they had this little note. He was buried January 12th. He died 2 days previously in a state of innocence. That's a cute phrase. He was probably out of it. He had lost his mind. Fell into him. Tombé en enfance in French, but fell into it. He had lost his mind. In a state of innocence. That was the end of it. He died. And with that being in 1800, he was 79 years old. He had a good life. 12 children. I put down a few of them because they might have an influence on what comes after. I put the 5 boys here. You can imagine after a few generations that the network of Faubaz in the Ottawa Valley is very complicated. We're going to talk about Gabriel now. And while Amable is the number one as far as the history of Cumberland Township is concerned, I must admit that Gabriel has me fascinated because of his lifespan and also because I've got enough stuff on him to write almost a book. Amable I'm having trouble getting, you have to have material on a person. But Gabriel, I pick up all kinds of stuff on him. He had a very rich life, and his lifetime spans incredible distances in terms of social organization and everything. Because he was born in 1754. That's under the French regime. So when he was born, his family had to work under a seigneur, just like I explained to Jean-Baptiste. When he died, all that was finished as far as Ontario, or excuse me, Upper Canada was concerned. And it was disappearing in Quebec because the seigneurial system, the feudal system, died out in Quebec around 1853. But it had been disintegrating way before that. Gabriel Faubert was born on April 16th, 1754. There were 6 years to go in the French regime. He married Marie-Josette Hull. Hull, same thing, same family. In this case, it's H-O-U-D-E. And I have rarely seen Hull, but I know that they're related. Marie Hull. They had more than five children, but I only put five there. He had four sons and four daughters. And as far as I know, he only had one wife, and she lived just about as long as he did. I don't have either that, but we'll talk about that in a minute. I found the marriage contract, because in Quebec, they had the custom of going to the notary and establishing a marriage contract. You didn't have to do that, but it would be a long document explaining what would happen if the couple split and things like that. Property decisions and all that was important. The French love to keep records. Just a little note here. All this tradition of parish registers, that's not from the beginning of the church at all. That started in the 1600s. When I visited the little village in France from which my ancestors came, near Germany in Haute-Champagne, I went to the first register, 1653, and the birth of my ancestor was not there, but his mother remarried, and that was the very first book, the first register. So that shows you that the custom of keeping parish registers in the Catholic Church only goes back to the 1600s. All kinds of things were happening then. And the church, which was already a pretty big bureaucracy, wanted to keep records on people. There's all kinds of reasons to keep registers. It sure is helpful to us now to be able to read through them. I already told you that he was there when they decided to build a stone church. Now that was 1783, so he's 29 years old. If he went to school, he should know how to sign his name, but he didn't sign his name. I'm puzzled by that, and I'll tell you what I think the explanation is, and we might have a discussion about it. 1796 is the next time I hear about this fellow. April 13th. A man by the name of William Fortune submits four lists of associates because they want to have a grant of land in Buckingham Township. Now this is getting very interesting. Buckingham Township, 1783. There's not a whole lot above the Lonceau. The Lonceau is an important stretch of rapids, 6 miles around Lorignal. It doesn't exist anymore because they built a dam at Carillon. When I started going to our cottage in 1956, there was no dam at Carillon. And I remember walking towards the center of that river, the Otto River, in the summer, 400 feet from where the water is now, into the center of that river. We could walk and walk in July, right into the middle. You can't do that anymore, and there are no more rapids. They call it, Lonceau means the long jump.
The schneid.
The schneid, yeah. 6 miles, when the voyage.
So that's why they need the bridge of Arc de Lonceau.
There you go, there you go. When the voyageurs left here in the spring, as soon as the ice broke, they left. They knew they had to go through. There were some rough rapids. They had 32 portages before they hit Michilimackinac up in the upcountry. But this 6 mile stretch was a bad one. and they had a whole bunch of them. All kinds of port tatties. Lonceau was a bad one. Anyways, let's get back to the story. William Fortune has four lists of associates because he wants land in Buckingham. This is a system of leader and associates. One man who's got a certain prestige, gets a bunch of people behind him. They promise to do certain things, get the land, and between you and me, it's all speculation because most of them sell it same day or the day after and make money out of it. That's why the British government stopped doing that, because there was abuse. But the point here is, out of all those associates, Gabriel Faubert is on there. And guess who else is on there? The Dunnings are on there. Now the Dunnings, you will remember, did I say that? No, maybe I didn't. The Dunnings are the first people who owned land in Cumberland Township. The first people. But that's 1801. I'm talking about 1796. And there's four lists for Buckingham Township, and they want land there. And it went through, but it went through around 1802. But this shows you that there's things happening in the valley, in the Lower Ottawa Valley, before the official history of Cumberland starts, and the official history of Buckingham too. That was 1796. William Fortune submits four lists of associates, and Gabriel is on one of them. Same year, December 11th, this is me in front of the microphone, his daughter, Marianne, is baptized in Vaudreuil. Gabriel is a trader on the Ottawa and signs Gabriel Faubert. Now that's very interesting. He signed his name now. This is 1796. Okay, there's a whole lot of stuff. This is just a couple lines, but we have to go over that because there's a lot of information here. She's baptized in Vaudreuil. When Jean-Baptiste was married, I might have induced it. If I said he got married in Vaudreuil, it's not true. He married a Vaudreuil woman, but they got married in Noka. And the reason was, there was no church in Vaudreuil. As the church develops, Quebec, Montreal, they're opening missions here all the time. Oka was open before Vaudreuil, and that's where Jean-Baptiste got, that's why he got married in Oka. When they opened up the parish in Vaudreuil, his children are baptized in Vaudreuil, and then things happened in Vaudreuil. Rigaud was a mission of Vaudreuil for a while, then they got their own church. And you're going to see this throughout the history of the valley. The parishes are opening up as the church moves into organized areas. And that's, if you want to know why I went to these microfilms in Vaudreuil and then in Rigaud and later on in Montebello, that's the reason. Because when these people were doing their thing, there were no churches anywhere here. The closest church was Vaudreuil. And this is not a hunch of mine, because in the genealogical compilation, I realized that things were they were being baptized or married or around these areas. And I said, I'm going to go to the parish registers of these places, because that's where the action is. And this is where I'm getting all my information. And I have to follow the parishes that open up. Because if somebody's up here and there's a parish opening up in Rigaud, he's not going to go on through to Vaudreuil. He's going to stop in Rigaud and have all his church business done there. And as soon as they open up a church in Montebello, all he has to do is go to Montebello and not go all the way down to Rigaud, you see? So I have to follow all these social patterns. Okay, now, I said he signed his name when the little girl was baptized. Here's my theory. I think that the women had a better chance to have that kind of education than the men did. The men were very busy on the land, clearing it, cultivating it, and if they were in the fur trade, they were all over the place. But the stable element was the wife. She would get home with the children. She had a better chance to pick up the rudiments of reading and writing, and I can see, I'm going to come back to this because it's going to happen with other couples. I can see a few moments being found for the man to sit down and feel a need. Maybe to sign his name, it would give him a little bit of prestige and to be able to read a little bit in business and stuff. But I think that in some cases, the women were doing this for the husband because there were no organized schools for quite a while. We're talking about, there was no social structure. Cumberland barely exists when I'm talking with you. There's no social pattern here. There's a few straggling settlers there, so you don't expect a school to be set up. How did these people learn to sign? Well, Jean-Baptiste, it's easy. He's come from a rather civilized country. Coming out of Paris, he's got a good chance to have learned to read and write. But how did Gabriel, born in Vaudreuil in 1754, how did he learn to sign his name? There might have been some things happening in Vaudreuil, but he's up and down the river. When I follow his life history, because when his daughter was baptized, he's a trader on the Ottawa. That's not a very good setup to be going to school. And he probably did that pretty early in his life, because life started very early in those days. He would have helped his father on the farm, and if he had itchy feet, he'd be up and down the river doing trade, because there was money in that. And schooling was way in the back of his mind, but maybe, as the years went on, he felt a need to learn to sign his name, at least, if not learn to read a little bit. The next time I see him on the microfilm, August 21st, the next year, 1797, his son Michel is baptized in Vaudreuil. The father is absent, and we know he's probably out in the bush doing the fur trade. The register says that he is a trader voyageur residing at La Barrière. And I want to take a couple of minutes to talk to you about La Barrière, because this is 1797. And the township of Cumberland was established in 1799. Forget the word Cumberland. Buckingham Township, 1799. Forget the word Buckingham. So how are we going to call these things? When I'm reading through the registers, it's things like up above the Lonceau. The Lonceau. Well, up above the Lonceau is, and that's up above everything. I mean, there's no hull. Philemon Wright comes in 1800. I put Ottawa there, then I blotted it out. When I'm talking to you tonight, there's no Ottawa. So where are they going to call these things, these places? La Barrière. Now, when I come across La Barrière, to this day I haven't been able to decide where it is, but we're going to spend 5 minutes on La Barrière because this is very interesting. I'm going to read to you a quotation now from a man who wrote the history of Buckingham. He's still alive. He was the archivist in Hull until recently, now he's in Montreal. Here's what he said. Soon after the conquest in 1761, Alexander Henry, who was a Scot, noted the existence of a trading post at the mouth of the Lièvre River. The Lièvre River is the one that flows past Buckingham and comes into the Ottawa River, not far, well, down from the Petrie Islands, not far from Cumberland Township here. Okay. Noted the existence of a trading post at the mouth of the Lièvre River. Was this the famous La Barrière post, or simply one of its outposts? During the same period, a post situated at Rockland, just above Clarence, there's Rockland, on the Ontario side of the Ottawa River, was thought to be the Barrière post. But no one knows for sure. Okay, the Lièvre, that's a very good place for a trading post. We know that there was a trading post there. You get the Indians. The Lièvre River is a system that goes in 380 miles. It drains a huge basin, smaller than the Gatineau Basin, but huge. This basin even links up with rivers going down to Trois-Rivières and La Mauricie. And when the Indians were hampered by the Iroquois, when the Algonquins were hampered by the Iroquois there, they had a shortcut. From below Quebec, they come up the back country and end up around this area, which was their traditional hunting ground, without encountering the Iroquois. And that was an ugly chapter of history, because the Algonquins were really almost annihilated by the Iroquois. The Hurons were annihilated. And the Algonquins, for 150 years, they couldn't come around here. They went back into the Manitoba foothills and all that, because they couldn't stay around the area here. See, that's a digression, but just to say that this is a great place for a trading post. Okay, I'm going to give you another quotation here. No, just a second. It's not a quotation. There's a priest who left Oka. His name was Father Hood, a Sulpician. He did the missions up and down the Yarrow River for a number of years. And he talks about La Barrière, but it's a little bit puzzling. He says that when he was doing his mission, he says that the old voyageurs had an expression for the area between the Nonceau and the Chaudière, because you can see both of these being major obstacles, the Chaudière Falls and the Nonceau. He says that the area between the two was called by the old voyageurs La Barrière. But that's a very vast area. And to say that Gabriel Faubert was residing in La Chaudière, I can't pinpoint. So we're going to have to come back to that a little bit later, but we're intrigued about La Barrière, you'll have to admit. Okay. The next time I encounter Gabriel is in 1800, and here's a quotation. This is not a microfilm of a registry, it's a quotation from a book. Gabriel Faubert and his wife were established at the mouth of the Lièvre River in 1800, having a house and other outbuildings. They were engaged in that year by the Northwest Company to trade with the Indians on behalf of the said company. This is taken from a book by Michael Newton, who worked for the National Capital Commission. He wrote a book on Baytown and the fur trade in 1991. He died soon after. That's not long ago. He was in his 40s. He could have done a lot. See, he had started to look into the fur trade in the Lower Ottawa River, the Lower Ottawa Valley, because not many people have talked about the Lower Ottawa Valley. There's all kinds of books on the Upper Ottawa Valley, but very little on the Lower Ottawa Valley. Okay, so we've got, in 1800, we have Gabriel Faubert at the mouth of the Lièvre River with his wife, Marie Hood, and he's got his children and all that. And then Philemon Wright comes up. That's the year that Philemon Wright came up the Hull from the States with his cattle, and a lot of people, 25 to 30 people came up with him. He had explored the country 1798, 99, and in 1800 he came up. And Hull is going to celebrate something in the year 2000. And we're talking about stuff around Cumberland in those years, and there's a dialogue going on, because we have certain claims to being old, and it's true, because Gabriel, you see, he's not settled. Well, this is a settlement, and to my people, opening up a trading post at the mouth of the Yed River is a form of settlement. He's not farming, he's trading. But that's the presence of some people here. Now I'm going to turn over. 1801. Records of Montreal merchants show that a Gabriel Faubert was established a short distance downriver from Bytown, probably at Rockland by 1801. This is by Bond, who wrote The Ottawa Country in 1968. That's a bit puzzling, because there's not a whole lot at Rockland. There's nothing at Rockland. I'm going to take 5 minutes to tell you something about a place close to Rockland. It's Butternut Grove. Not Rockland, about 4 miles from Rockland, Butternut Grove. Under the French regime, there was a trading post there. And a man by the name of James Fox, who came up in 1793. You know, when they say that Philemon Wright was the first one, he was not the first one to come up. James Fox came up in 1793. He had married someone, a French-Canadian lady in Quebec. And he came up in 1793, and he didn't stay below the Nonceau. He went right up there. And he settled near Clarence. There was no Clarence there. He settled near there. And before he died, he talked to a French woman in the area of Butternut Grove, which is now Rockland. And this woman was getting on in age. She had an important husband. He was a count or something, that could be any title. He had died. and the journeyman who was helping them, a man by the name of Perrault, she established a social and probably a matrimonial relationship with this man. And Mrs. Perrault talked to James Fox before she died. And she said that there was an active fir trade for years there at Butternut Grove. And she saved a British officer's life once. He had been captured by Indians. And this is some of the gruesome stuff in the history. And they were prepared to torture this poor wretch because that was their one of their forms of entertainment and revenge and everything you want. And Mrs. Perrault was able to cajole these people, get the men away, and cajole the children with candies and stuff. And she was able to smuggle the poor officer into her post, get him into bed as if he was the lady's mother. She managed to tell the Indians not to go bother her mother. And she got a thank you from the British. I would love to find more about this. I can't find anything, but this is a story that was handed down to people in Clarence. And I got my hands on it in a book that was published by the son of the famous minister, Minister Edwards, John Edwards, who was an important minister up and down the river for quite a while. And all of this was handed down. And if I can ever open a new leaf on that, because you see, we're turning around some ancient history here. That Bodega, to me, is either, not in Rockland, but in this Butternut Grove area. Or it was at the mouth of the Dieppe, or it could very well have been for both. Because we talked about outposts of another, you know, a post could have a branch post and all that. So, but we're very close here. A canoe can do that very easily before lunch. These guys were in shape. They'd leave early and they would, that was not a problem. And when you say that you live in an area, these people living in an area, like Gabriel was known to be out in the bush most of the time, you'd talk to his wife, and when is Gabriel showing up? She didn't know, and he just showed up when he showed up. We know he showed up once in a while because I've seen the baptism, so. Okay. 1801. This time it's a child who was buried in Vaudreuil. Marie Hood had a baby and didn't even give it a name, so he probably died right after birth. Aged about 1 month, and here we have a bit of information. Gabriel, a trader at the Chaudière. This is 1801. I have a vision in my head that when Fillmore Wright came up, and there's a whole account of that, how an Indian helped him. He met an Indian up around here, probably around St. Andrews East, and the Indian couldn't believe what he was seeing, cattle on the river. And these men were going with axes, and they were afraid of the river. They were afraid to sink in somewhat with the cattle and stuff. And the Indian had never seen anything like that. He had his wife and a baby with him. He left the wife and baby in the bush, and he escorted Philemon right into Hull, got his thank yous and a few gifts and stuff, and came back to his family. Now, I have a vision that when this procession was going on up the river in 1800, can't prove it, but I think that Gabriel probably knew about it, because that was his territory. He'd been there for a few years. Next I hear about Gabriel is 1809. We're jumping a little bit. On October 16th, Dr. Geneviève marries. Oh, okay, see, the generations are coming in. Gabriel is old enough to have a daughter of his marrying a gentleman by the name of Joseph Séguin, and they marry Nérigot. Sure, they marry Nérigot because in 1802, the church opened in Nérigot, and they no longer had to go to Vaudreuil, and they went to Nérigot. And what am I doing now? I'm sitting in front of Nérigot microfilms and picking up all kinds of little tidbits. Vaudreuil is almost useless to me now. And soon Nérigot will not be useful to me, and I'll have to sit in front of the Montebello microfilm. Pick up the information there. Although, even after Montebello was open, I noticed that the Fauberts are going down to Rigaud for their church business, so to speak. And I know why, because they have a lot of relatives in Ligo. And I can see a mother who's pregnant in those days, she's very interested in finding a midwife, because sometimes I think about the women who live in this ancient time. The men were doing their thing in the bush, but the woman having her baby in these rough circumstances, no doctors. You wanted a midwife if you could. And if you had relatives in the Ligo, it was a good idea to have a little trip when you were getting on with your pregnancy. Because here you've got sisters-in-law, brothers-in-law, and a kind of a support system. And it's a lot easier to get the child baptized if you're right near the church also. So there were good reasons for the Fopas to come down to Ligo every once in a while. Just a word here about the support system. When the French Canadians moved in to Cumberland Township, what a wonderful support system they had. They had relatives all over the place. Not just the Fobac, all of them. The people who came from the continent, from the British Isles or from elsewhere, even the States, they didn't have the same support system. These people, the Fobas, were rooted in the lower Ottawa Valley from day one. Whatever was happening up and down this river, they were there. They had been there for a while. They were rooted into the lower Ottawa Valley.
This concludes side one of the presentation by Bob Saray on September 1st, 1999. Please turn the tape over now to continue listening to side two. Because this was taped at a live meeting on September 1st, 1999, there will be approximately 3 to 4 minutes of this tape which will be blank until you get to the beginning of Bob's side two on his presentation of September the 1st, 1999.
1820. This is a little bit, there's two sides to this story. 1820. Famous Father Rupp I talked about. He's been doing the mission for 4 years, and he writes a report saying that he has been celebrating Mass at the Fobad household for 4 years in 1820, but that this fine gentleman has gone into the nasty habit of selling rum to the Indians and keeping a tavern, and that Father Rupp feels it inappropriate for him to continue celebrating Mass at the Fobad household, and he found another place. In defense of the Fobads, I must say that in those days, and for 100 years before, you could not trade with the Indians if you did not have fire water, period. Case dismissed. Everywhere you went, Michilimackinac, up in the back country, close country, no matter where you were, you couldn't do it, because if you didn't sell them rum, there were lots of people up and down and all over the place who would have a barrel of rum somewhere and they could do business. So Father Rupp had to do his job and Gabriel had to do his business, because he had mouths to feed, and he knew as well as any man how the fur trade went. So that's it. I'll leave you to decide who was right and who was wrong. By the way, Father Rupp had a big problem with mixed marriages, not French-English. He had a problem with mixed marriages between French-Canadian and Indian, and that got him into trouble. There is evidence that he was called back to Montreal from Oka because he refused to marry certain couples, and it made a big row, and he made a fuss about it, and he was eventually recalled because this was a delicate social subject. A lot of people were intermarried. You can't stop that anywhere, anytime. It's a fact of life. Another digression, let's get back. Now I jump to 1826. His son Antoine marries Angélique Morin in Montebello. You see, we're moving into Montebello. That opened up in 1815. It had been a mission of Oka, 1815, to build a church. So, if it's not urgent to go to Ligo, the people from Cumberland area can go to Montebello for their Catholic services or
do I have here for Gabriel? Yeah, it says he's a farmer in Le Havre Township. Oh, now that's interesting.
Gabriel starts out on his father's farm. He does a lot of fur trading. I know for a fact he did some lumbering, because at a certain stage a lot of people were doing lumbering when they were clearing land. And now his son gets married and we've got him as a farmer in Le Havre Township. Gabriel moved around in his life. He's following things. Wherever the action is, that's where he is. I've got him showing up in Ottawa in the fur trade. Not Ottawa, Bytown later, when it started, it was Bytown. So, the life and times of Gabriel Faubert are spent in the lower Ottawa Valley. He's not a man who you can pinpoint easily. You can follow him with little traces here and there, but this man is on the move regularly. I don't know when he died, and I don't know when Matty Hood died. I have them at a baptism in 1827. Now, in 1827, we've got him as 46 plus 27, 70, and he's in his 70s now. So they both live to a ripe old age. Someday hopefully I'll find their death certificate or something, but right now I don't know. And time's going on, and I want to leave a period for questions, so I'm going to go right into Ahmed now, who's also dear to my heart. There's a lot in the life of Ahmed also. Ahmed, I found his baptism just 2 months ago during my holidays. I went to Hull, because this was all by deduction. I said, he's got to be in a certain time slot. And sure enough, I end up in Hull, pick up the microfilm, 15 minutes. I figure it's got to be 1782, because of all the stuff I've been doing. I sit down and 15 minutes, sure enough. And I'm going to read to you, word for word, that's my translation there, what a baptism act looks or sounds like in the Catholic register. Here it is. In the year 1782, on March 30th, the undersigned priest baptized Antoine Amable, born this very day of the lawful marriage of Gabriel Faubert and of Marie-Josette Hood, his father and mother. The godfather was Amable Duplanty, and the godmother Charlotte Grandin, wife of Alexis Duplanty, who, upon being invited to sign, said they could not. Julie read, the priest would read it back. Signed, De Guille, priest. You see, look at all the stuff we have here. The godmother, I even know who's her husband. I have her maiden name, I've got her husband, I've got the godfather. Sometimes they tell you what the father does, they tell you if he's absent, and all kinds of stuff. This is a rich pattern, and this is what gets me fired up as soon as I see. And if I'm reading all kinds of stuff, they can show up anywhere. Faubert can show up anywhere. Godfather, godmother, son, married. And if you read all the acts, it takes me an hour to do a year. About an hour to do 1 year in one register. But you pick up, really it's like little, very small nuggets in a large pot. But sometimes you're now, what am I doing here? Now something, that's why you're there, because you find a little bit of information. Okay, 1807 now, I've got his birth. That's a big deal for me, because now I can talk about his age and stuff, and I know roughly how to fit this man in. Born in 1782. Now in 1807, this is oral history. I don't have any papers. It's like the 1801 purchase by the Dunnings of supposedly 800 acres. I don't have a document for that. Oral history in Carmel Township says that the Dunnings came in 1801. That same oral history says that Ahmed Faubert came in 1807. Got some land from the Dunnings, not from the Crown, not from the Dunnings. Lot 14, Concession 1, old survey, remember that. And he settled, he established a fur trading post. His father already had one. He established one in Carmel Township. Now, all kinds of things are happening here. And I don't have documents. I can't find the marriage record for Gabriel. Whom did he marry? Matilda Dunning. Now, when I saw that, when I started doing my research and I saw this, I said, what's that? The Dunnings from the States? Possibly Methodist? Probably not in agreement, all in agreement anyways, with such a marriage. How old were they? Can't find the marriage record. Can't find it. I'm not too surprised because in 1807, the churches are far. And this is not an ordinary marriage. Protestant, Catholic, this is tricky. I had visions of shotgun weddings. Maybe he was 14 years old. What? I couldn't imagine what had happened. But when you put this together here, 1782, he was born. Okay, now, I have seen documents where he was supposed to have been born in 1790, and that would make him pretty young in 1807, 17. But if he was born in 1782, and that's documented, well, in 1807, a man's 24, 25 years old. So, it puts a little bit of different color on it. And then I'm starting to find children. See, this is where we start to weave the pattern of the man's life, because I don't have his marriage record. But when the little babies start coming along, I start getting some tidbits of information. 1807, an Apfelbert arrived about it and established a furring booth. Now, he was a freelance trader. We're going to come back to that because I don't want to get into a big discussion. He wasn't working for the Hudson's Bay Company, as far as I know, and he wasn't working for the Northwestern. He was a free trader on his own, intercepting the Indians coming up and down, making a fairly good living at that, thank you very much, and doing his own thing and not taking orders from other people. That was the kind of style I had. When I look, when I see Amab, I see an independent fur trader. 1811 in Rigaud. I've got three baptisms, and this is definitely worth a couple of minutes because the first time I went to the register, I was only looking for the baby who was born at that time. But when I went back and did my systematic search through the microfilm, I found a third baptism on that very same day. And this made my face drop because the two babies were baptized, number two and three, but the first baptism was Matilda Dunning. And this is 1811. Now this is starting to be very interesting because, by the way, those two babies who were baptized, they were 2 and 3 years old, because Amab comes in 1807, and I'm sure he started the family quite soon after that, because if you backtrack from these baptisms, the babies were born 1808, 1809, and they were married, because I'm going to come to that in a minute. But so Matilda Dunning is baptized right before her two children, same day. This is February 19th, and we're in Rigaud, 1811. Well, that means that they did not marry in the church. They couldn't, because if you marry in the Catholic Church, all this rigmarole you have to have gone through that before. If she is baptized a few years after the first babies are born, they got married, I don't know where, but not in the Catholic Church. But I have evidence, and it's coming up, that they definitely were married. Probably by a Protestant minister, and that would not have been unusual. I just want to keep coming, we'll come back to that. But you see how things get complicated, so. Here's my triple baptism. Rose Matilda Dunning. And because they're so complete, we find out a lot of things. She was born on 17 April 1791. Daughter of Salmon Dunning and Deborah Royce. They messed up the word. I know it's Deborah Royce. Farming above the Nonceau. Again, this vague term. Farming above the Nonceau. That's Salmon. Father absent. Salmon is absent. Godfather Michel Faubert. Sure, Michel Faubert. Jean-Baptiste had a son called Michel. He's living in Rigaud. You want to find the godfather? No problem. Where did he go? Michel Faubert, godfather. Who's the godmother? Marie Hood. Oh, Gabrielle's wife. We're in good company. Matilda was baptized in Rigaud. And then she probably goes back to her in-laws. And the baptism, you don't have to have the mother. And we know the father should be absent. We've seen that quite a few times. So probably in the afternoon, I suppose, they baptized two little girls, Marguerite and Marie-Sara. One was born on 28 October 1808, like I said. That's the first child I see for this couple, 1808. And here's what the register says. Born 28 October of the lawful wedding of Amade Faubert and Rose Mathilde Dunn. Farming above the Lonceau. Not very precise, but we're used to that by now. But born of the lawful wedding. That's important to me. It's important to me to know because Marie-Sara, born 30 November 1809, father absent. Now what we have here is three baptisms on one day. These people are not close to the Rigaud church and they're not worried about going to church every Sunday like I was worried when I was a little boy growing up with a French Canadian Baptist. We had to go to church every day. These people, and this is a long time ago, they come down to Rigaud when it suits the purpose and they have something worthwhile, like two babies and maybe the mother to be baptized. That was a worthwhile trip to Rigaud. But they're not, they don't come up and down all the time. And here's the very next entry I have here, and it's 8 o'clock and I want to get on, is another triple baptism. This time it's in 1814, it's March 8th, and we're in Rigaud again. Jean-Baptiste, born up country in 1809. That means anywhere up above the Lonceau. Of unknown parents. Happened all the time. Godmother Matilda Dunning, signs. Son, okay, that's the first, the reason I picked that baptism, it's not related, but Matilda chooses to be godmother and she signs. When these little babies were brought down the river to parents unknown, and they could come in from Michilimackinac all the way down, somebody had to be found to be godfather and godmother. In this case, Matilda Dunning did it. But always they found two people in Rigaud to do that. There was a certain generosity because being a godfather, he took a certain responsibility for these lost children coming down of parents unknown. You know, reading microfilms can be very poignant sometimes. Because 5 minutes ago, I saw the baby being baptized, and now I see it being buried. And I see people dying young, and I see people dying of different illnesses. I see people dying old. I see a whole picture of village life unfolding in front of me through this dull pursuit of reading microfilms, hour after hour. There are some good things that come of that. And you get an overpowering impression of the village life. It's very, very poignant. I said it was a triple baptism. This unknown little boy, not baptism. Second baptism, the son of Amad is André Amad. Oh, André Amad. André dropped. That's this guy. Amad, his son. He was born December 3rd, 1811, and another son, Alexandre, who was born 30 December 1813. Amab is absent, but they baptized those two little boys. Amab is living in Upper Canada. Oh, that's the first time I hear that. He's living in Upper Canada. 1791 is when that was official. 1791, Upper Canada is constituted. So we have a reference here to Upper Canada, above the Lonceau. Well, we're used to that. Soon they'll stop saying above the Lonceau and it'll just be, they'll know, but in Upper Canada, above the Lonceau. Now, Amad and Matilda lived for many years together and they had three sons and six daughters, as far as I know. Sometimes there's a mix-up because a little baby is born and when that person marries 20 years down the line, names shift
And if you think sometimes it's two people, it's not, it might be the same person. So that's why I say three sons and six daughters, give or take. Because this is not an exact science, I mean, this is a lot of intuition and a lot of deduction. The next reference is 1815. San Gabriel is baptized in Montebello. They didn't have to go so far. Amable was absent again. But this time it says he's residing this side of the Chaudière Falls. Okay. We know the Chaudière, that's where Hal is. This side of the Chaudière Falls. December 11th, same year, 1815. Amable's brother, Michel, because Gabriel had a son, Michel. These are brothers. Michel dies. He's buried in the Rigaud. He's only 18 years old. Amable is present, and he cannot sign his name. That's what the register says. Sometimes the register doesn't have something that doesn't talk about it, but when they do say that the man was invited to sign and he could not, that's pretty conclusive that he could not sign his name. 18 years old for young Michel. Now what's happening here? We're in 1815. The timbering, the lumbering operations have started. And when I'm reading this microfilm, people are dying on rafts, drowning, fall off the raft, probably in the bush. I know what, I've read a lot about cutting down trees and stuff. And sometimes you didn't know where the tree was falling, and sometimes people weren't careful, and men got killed out in the bush. And I hear about it in the Rigaud or Vaudreuil or this and that. And they're young men, 18, 25. This is a young man's work. So that was a sad moment. Michel was there, and his father was there, and two brothers, and he could not sign. 1818, Amab's daughter, Véronique, is baptized in Montebello. Amab and Mathilde are both present, and both sign. That's only 3 years. So I come back to the vision I had of some evenings being spent at home, and Mathilde, who could sign the name, we know that. Maybe she taught Amab how to, the rudiments of reading and writing. I know that some of the children learned it, because the children end up signing the register as godfathers or godmothers. You can be quite young and be a godfather or godmother. So this, I see something happening in the family here, because I don't think there were any schools in Cumberland in 1815. And since, you know, you could say that the other families, well, they were around Rigaud or Vaudreuil and there were schools there, but no. Mathilde and Amab are in above the Monceau. I don't know of any schools up there. I can only see Mathilde sitting down with Amab and her children. And that's a nice warm vision to see families going into this kind of thing. Because everything is a normal offshoot of other stuff before. When they opened up the first school in Cumberland, things have been happening in school. There's always an infrastructure. And what I'm doing tonight, there's a kind of an official oral history of Cumberland, but you can see that I've been digging in 20, 30 years before that. There's always something that prepares what becomes official history. And the digging into the unofficial history is what fascinates me. Now, I want to move on because I want to give people a chance to ask questions. I'm even going to cut it short. One thing that's important for you to know is that I come across a register record in 1832. This is when Amable Jr. married Paulette Morin in Montebello. And Mathilde Dunning is shown as being deceased. Now that's another thing about Catholic registers. If one of the parents in the marriage is dead, they say it. That's usually summarized by one letter. F, feu in French means deceased. That letter in front of a person's name, in the register, I would have to record that stuff. The first time I saw that, I barely recognized it. But soon, I wanted to know what had happened to Mathilde, because I couldn't find the record of her death. But when her son got married, it says she was deceased. Now that's 1832, she's not old. You know that she was born in 1791. We have a record of that, 1791. This is
She has to have died before 1832 because in 1832 she's already dead. Now that's only 41 years old. I think she had a pretty rough life. She might have died in childbirth. That was not unusual. I think she, well, 41, she was not past the age of having children, but I don't know. I don't think I'll ever know that, things like that. I don't think I'll ever find the marriage of an Amadou. Just a little word on that. I've read some rather humorous reports that if you were a young couple in love, let's say around Buckingham in the old days, the church didn't like you to marry Protestant close to home, you could actually go three quarters across the river, on the Otto River from Buckingham. You're still on the river, and lo and behold, a minister is coming down from an area in Upper Canada, and he has agreed to marry couples who wish to bless their matrimonial union, and that was done. There was, you could arrange for that. And I've seen in the registers, sometimes the priest would say that these people had been married by a Protestant minister, and sometimes the priest, the Catholic Church, would expect them to renew their marriage vows, or would consider that as a lawful wedding and let things go as they were. You see, that's what I think happened with Amad and Matilda. In the circumstances, they probably had their marriage blessed by a Protestant minister. And the favor was repaid the other way around countless times, because in the old days, if you met a man of the cloth, you didn't ask questions, because they came around every 2-3 years. And I've got a record of Salmon Dunning having one of his children baptized in Montebello by Father Rook, because that was probably the most convenient thing for him to do at the moment. And if Amad decided to marry Matilda Dunning in the presence of a Protestant minister, that's okay too. But we know that all the children were baptized, and Matilda bothered, she decided to be baptized in the Catholic Church. And that is some of the web we can weave around the lives of these people if we dig deep enough, and that's what I am going to continue doing. And the point of this evening was that if I publish a book in 2 years from now, it'll have all this and more. But tonight I was able to communicate some of this feeling and information to you, and it might trigger new things in that, and that's a very useful way to spend an evening, to share this kind of information while it's hot off the microphone. Now, I would like, it's 8:10, and we're going to have a little snack, I heard, after. And I would like to give you a chance to ask questions, and I'm going to have another guzz of water. Where is it in a cup of water? Thank you.
Could you get it as far as the Colbert family settling, like around Leonard?
No, I think the people who can, around Leonard, I think the people who are going to tell you that, even the people in the room here tonight, because you, I don't know if I didn't introduce people here tonight. Are you Dr. Ferguson? No?
No,
no.
No?
Francis
Colbert.
Oh, okay.
Like they were Colbert.
Okay, yeah.
His neighbors.
I just wanted to get that to you. Ted Fauvet is here tonight. He's the grandson of Napoleon. Grew up in Sarsfield. Edith Fauvet is here tonight. Are you a
professional?
You're a, my goodness. Could you just put the link with Napoleon? How does that, is that in
English? Je pense que
mon grand-père
était à Cumberland. Il était à Cumberland parce qu'il était à Sarsfield.
Okay. That sounds like
c'est là que je suis née, mais les autres, ils étaient à Cumberland.
Well, if they came from the other side of the river, I'm translating. This lady was born in Cumberland, and they moved to Sarsfield. And the ancestors came from the house. Now, don't forget, there were Fauvets up and down the river, but they all link up to these people at the top. Now, the question I was asked is if I've been able to trace Faubert to Leonard, and the problem there is that I can't compete with people who are still alive today who know that intimately. I've got charts at home and all that, but my pursuit is to try to dig into the roots of all this, because then if I can talk to people and link them up to their ancestors and this side, they're clean sailing all the way back. The rest of this development is going to come with time, and it's not my priority right now, because I didn't say this, but my expertise is the first 50 years. I want to develop the history of Cumberland for the first 50 years, because it seems to me that that's the most obscure part of our history. After 1850, we have a municipal council, we have an organization, we have schools, we have all kinds of things. But before 1849, it's obscure. And the further back you go, like when these first people came in, it's not clear at all. And that's what I want to dig into. So the answer is, I'm afraid not. But that'll come.
The father was Napoleon Colbert.
It
would
be
in the 1900s.
Yeah. Well, Napoleon was born in 1856, and you know he died in 1941. Yeah. I mean,
well, was
did you have the Napoleon's brothers?
Oh, we've got charts with that.
Yeah.
See, like, the answer is, I don't know about that, but we have, in our history room, it's right here. In our history room, we have a charts and all kinds of stuff that'll give you the links. Like, Napoleon had a son, many children, but one son, Rupert, had 16 children. And Ted Faubert, that's his father, Rupert. So, and Edith, what your father was?
Franks.
Oh, your mother was a Faubert. Yeah, okay. But you see, this, it wouldn't take you long to get all that.
Napoleon was Franks' neighbor then.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. So you remember
Napoleon
Faubert?
Yeah,
the
Does this look anything like him? This is what has been donated to us by Ted Faubert, was gracious enough to donate this to our society.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And Ellen Swain. That's Napoleon's wife, Ellen Swain. A good-looking woman. Oh, yeah. And that was donated also by Ted. And we're going to hang it up in the room, you see.
What? In 1922,
yeah,
my father built a barn, a new barn.
Yeah. That was Camille.
Camille, yes. And there was, the framer was Trifle Faubert.
Huh.
And Napoleon Faubert worked for my father, 1922, when they built the barn.
Oh boy.
But was this, I wonder if this is the same Napoleon.
Yes.
Must
be.
Oh yeah.
Yes.
That's it.
Trifle was his brother?
Yeah.
I don't remember.
Yeah,
Trifle
was
his
brother.
Trifle was his brother.
I remember Trifle.
He was a framer.
I don't know.
Trifle Faubert was the lady's uncle. You see, this
my
umbrella.
Brother was a Miss Ball, and his brother was Thursday, and there was a few more.
You see, these people are still alive, and they can zero in on what your name, what you're asking, much better.
Yeah.
So there's a, these are a rich pattern of relationships. Yeah. Yes, Jeannie.
Do you know that there are tombstones down at that, well, I suppose that the South Place, the Denny's, and I was down there last week with Pat, and right up by the highway, I looked down and you look at these stones and these names are there, but Sal and Denny.
Where is this?
At the South, just right east of our place. And there's Mr. Lepage, who his brother was Paul Lepage, he was councillor from Sarsfield.
That's very...
He's building, you know, where Pat.
That's been a puzzle for a while. Where was the Dunning Cemetery?
Yeah. It was right there at LaSalle's.
Yeah. I heard about that.
Yeah, and there's Zelma Dunning and Little Dog.
We're going to have to look into that. You know, that there are restrictions. Cemeteries are sacred things, and we have to.
I heard about this one.
Yeah. Yeah, but this is a tombstone you saw.
Yeah.
We have to look into that. Sure. There, Zalman Gunning is not a very frequent name anywhere, and around here there's one. Now, this is interesting because people were poor in those days, and they were buried on their own land. So the Fobad had their own cemetery, and the Gunnings had their own cemetery. There were public cemeteries that came along. But you lived and died and were buried on your own land in those days, and there was a lot of pride to that. What happened later is with development. Some of them, these are sacred places, and some of them were violated. You don't hold those up.
And we're more in the Dale House, you know, my Joe, that's where the house is. Do you know which of those two bears lived in that
green? Probably Napoleon, this one. But he moved out, the house burned down in. The old homestead burned down in 1897 or something.
And
the new house was built in 1915.
And that same spot?
Same spot.
That was thought that was a husband's report.
Well, you see, when I made a point that Amanda was an independent fur trader, some people say he works for the Northwesters, some people say he works for the Hudson's Bay Company. I have not found documented evidence of that. It's oral history. It's not impossible, but I can't say it for sure. But I do have some documents that say that he was a fur trader, and as a matter of fact, the big companies, I've got records of the big companies complaining about these free traders because they'd intercept the Indians and make deals before the big companies could get the best furs, and this aggravated the big companies, that's the Hudson's Bay and the Northwest. It aggravated them. So I know that Gabriel was a fur trader, and his son, if you tell me I've got documents saying he was an independent fur trader, I'm not surprised. Now, for him to have made a contract, maybe later on, or at one stage, he might have had one or a few years working for the Hudson's Bay, but I have not been able to confirm that. And yet, the oral tradition does mention it. So that's one I'm still, there's a lot of things that are still up in the air, and sooner or later you can nail it down. But right now, I can't. So we have four, this is great, we have four people of the Fulbright family with them. And some people still remember them. Yes?
My name is Alain Fulbert.
I was wondering if you had stepped into the room. Thank you for number five, because you're the one who has the website.
Yes.
So welcome to our meeting.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I have a question for you.
Yes.
It's about the birthday.
Yes.
How did you find out?
Well, I went to
Holland. Is that on the
But you see,
you were able to make a connection with the parents, Gabriel.
Yeah. Now, I'll read it again, but you see, Vaudrey, just a second here, where am I? 1782. 1783, they built a stone church. And the records start, I have a manuscript record on the microphone. I can read that more easily than their handwriting. Now, I can't find Ahmad as of 1783 on the typescript in the microphone. I said, if he wasn't born after 1783, maybe he was born before 1783. And because I know that Gabriel was married in 1779 or something. There's only a 3-year slot there, 1779 to 82 for him, I think. So I go to Hull and I figure I'll go start back from 82, 81, 80, right? So the marriage, and bang, 82, I found him right away, see? And since you want to confirm about his parents, that it's very well the Ahmad we're talking about, in the year 1782, the undersigned priest baptized Antoine Ahmad, this is the register, born this very day of the lawful marriage of Gabriel Fobad and Marie-Josette Hood, which puts it exactly where we want it. The godfather was at Tebert Federates. That's how I know that I've got the right man, because let me tell you, Ahmad, I'm up to six now. The reason I put this man here is that that's the first Jean-Baptiste.
He had a son called Ahmed, brother of Gabriel. I find a document in Lorignal talking about Ahmed, and it can't be my Ahmed here. And I don't know where to fit him in, so let's just leave him here for a second. I got 1, 2, 3 Ahmeds here, right bang in my line.
Yeah, that's what you would for the
And then I...
The first one.
Yeah, yeah. And I find, and this is all tradition too, that there was an Ahmed Foubert who had children by an Indian woman. Now, and some people let me believe that it might have been my Ahmed here, the first pioneer. And I don't like that, because I know that Ahmed, who married Matilda Dunning, had several children. And I see them being born every 2 years, regular as clockwork. And I say, how do we get an Indian woman and him having children by that Indian woman? That doesn't fit in too good. This is a man who bothers to have his children baptized in the church. Matilda was baptized in the church. You know, I have to... When I started out, I didn't know what to believe, but now I have the picture of Ahmed as a steady man. Now, I've got some records, and the little baby who was born of this Antoine and an Indian woman. First one, I got 3 children. One is Leon, and the father is a hunter of unknown address. That doesn't help me too much, but the woman is a Kawi. I have her name, it sounds like an Algonquin name, Watch, he finishes with Watch. I find 2 little girls being born later on. And the last time, the last little girl, it says that this man is in Gatineau. He's living in Gatineau. Okay. I don't think it's my Ahmed here at all. Now, how do I get another Ahmed in the picture? Because we're coming on, and this is 1820s, 1830s. Well, Ahmed here could very well have had other. Or there any? A lot of these sons all over the place could have had. I mean, Gabriel shows up every generation. Michel, there's several Michel. And so there's I'm going to connect it sometime. You're aware of it. I'm aware of it. But how do we connect it? I can't assume it's my man here. I have to assume it's some other man. I'm still working on it. You're puzzled.
He didn't marry after she died yet.
That's a good question. Oh,
Marry the Indian after she died.
Well, that's very possible, but she died in 32, he's 18, he's in his 40s, it's not impossible. But the little babies who were born, these 3, doesn't fit very well. But when did Ahmed die? Like we know that Matilda was dead by 1832. I spent most of my summer going through the 1861 census, which is a painful process, because it's handwritten. But I found something at the end of one, there's 4 enumeration districts, and I found something at the end of one of the districts. Living with Duncan Cameron on lot 18, concession 1, he's a farmer born in Scotland, and his wife is Betsy McMillan. Now, living with Duncan Cameron is Ahmed Foubert, born in Lower Canada, age 78, or 1961. 61 from 78, leaves 17. 17 from 1800. Ah, very close to 1782. Born in Lower Canada? Sure, Vaudreuil. That's my man. 1861. Can't be the other man. And here's the man. He's still alive in 1861, and he's 78 years old.